Morning,
this is Michael Gibbons in Carson City. I'm joined by Judge Jerry Tao in Las Vegas and Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. They're both on the bench and they're wearing masks because they're in close proximity to each other. Okay. This is comes to our 1 year anniversary of starting oral arguments by video. So fortunately, it's an anniversary that's going to not be repeated, it looks like, and actually will be coming to an end soon. But for now, the process continues, and we appreciate counsel appearing in this fashion. It's worked out pretty well. Once in a while, we've had a glitch. If there is a problem, we'll just stop and see if we can correct it. In one situation, we had to revert to the telephone, but fortunately, that only happened one time. So we're happy to have both of you here today. Before I officially announce the case, I let the judges in Las Vegas say hello, make sure everything's working down on that end too. Judge Tao, do you have any opening comments?
Well, first of all, can everybody hear me? I just want to make sure all the mics are working. Everyone can hear me? Okay.
Yes, Judge.
It's good to see you guys. Appreciate your working with us. This is how we're doing things now, although as Judge Gibbons mentioned, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We may not be doing it this way for much longer, but we do appreciate your working with us. I know this is a little bit more annoying because you guys have to call in, work with our IT guys, work through any glitches, and so it becomes like, instead of a half hour argument, it becomes a whole like hour long endeavor for everybody involved, but we do appreciate it, and at least this court is open and we're moving ahead, and this is the best we can come up with, but we're really looking forward to the argument today.
Hey, thank you. Judge Bulla.
Good morning. I hope you all can hear me. Judge Tao and I are wearing masks, and I know that's a little bit of a disadvantage for you all because you cannot see our facial expressions. We will do our best to talk clearly. If you have any questions or concerns or you are unable to hear us, let us know. We'll try not to talk over you. I know it's sometimes difficult because you can't tell when we might have a question that we just have to ask. So please bear with us, and thank you all so much for being here this morning.
Okay. Right. I want to confirm the presence of counsel. This is case number 79431-COA. Juan Gautam versus Bank of America. It's the time set for the oral argument. We have the appellant present through attorney Micah Eccles. Mr. Eccles, say hello.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Okay. And we have the respondent present through attorney John Dormey. And correct me if I pronounce your name wrong.
That's pretty close, Your Honor. Dormey.
Dormey. Okay.
Closer than most.
M-E, just like it's spelled. All right, Mr. Eccles, as the appellant, would you like to reserve any time for a rebuttal argument?
I would, Your Honor. I'll attempt to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, all right, we'll set it at 5 minutes. Of course, it might end up being less than that if we go over. You should be able to see the clock. I have a screen in front of me that shows four parts, and one of them is the clock. Hopefully you have the same thing.
I do, Your Honor. I can see the clock, too.
All right. Okay, this is an interesting case in security related to an incident that happened at the Bank of America parking lot. And we set this for argument because we thought it did have some interesting issues. So we're happy to be here and hear what you have to say. Mr. Eccles, you can go forward.
Thank you, Your Honor. Micah Eccles for the appellant, Pollen Gautam. So this is a negligence case that has three legal issues that we've presented. And I actually want to start with, I want to flip the issues from what we had in our briefing. So I want to start with Jonathan Simon's qualifications. Jonathan Simon was excluded by the district court prior to trial in a motion in limine. And then we did an offer of proof. It was during jury selection at the trial. Just to give the judge another opportunity to weigh Mr. Simon's qualifications and also to see if we could get him to testify. Ultimately, the case was dismissed by a 50A motion, and so the jury never decided any of the issues. But here's really the way that I see this issue.
Wait, Mr. Eccles, could you clarify one thing, Your Honor, procedurally? So you said it was a two parts regarding the witness, Mr. Simon. At the motion in limine before trial, did Mr. Simon testify?
No, Your Honor. He did not testify in the motion in limine hearing. He only testified in an offer of proof outside the presence of the jury.
Okay, so we have that transcript in the record, a little over 50 pages from his testimony at the trial. So that's when he officially stated what his qualifications were and what his testimony would be.
It was in both instances, Your Honor, because in the if you look at the papers, the opposition to the motion in limine, it outlines his qualifications. A copy of his report's attached. A copy of his CV is also attached to that opposition, and that's in the respondent's appendix.
All right.
Those filings.
All right. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead with your point.
Thank you, Your Honor. So this issue really focuses on the statutory language of NRS 50.275, testimony by experts. And of course, we have the Supreme Court's Hallmark versus Eldridge case that expands on these factors. But the language of the statute on the qualification prong says a witness qualified as an expert by special knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education may testify to matters within the scope of such knowledge. And it's the reason I emphasize the or in the plain language of the statute, Your Honors, is because really the sense that I got from reading over Judge Crockett's ruling is that he wanted it to be an and. He wanted Mr. Simon to be certified in order to have him testify. And we cited the Freeman versus Davidson case, which says an expert does not need to be licensed to testify as an expert, because there are many alternative grounds upon which an expert is qualified. So really the reason we offered Mr. Simon as an expert is to go over the NRS 660 standards that it was our contention that he properly challenged from Bank of America, and also that there was enough evidence there that he should have been able to testify. And that really goes to the 50A issue.
I apologize. Let me just interrupt you for a minute. Are you saying that Judge Crockett made the decision to exclude the expert solely based on certification? Or were there other factors that the judge considered when making the decision?
I think the main issue was his lack of certification. And I don't think he correctly followed all the factors in 50.275 as expanded upon by the Hallmark case. And really exactly what the judge is ruling, we don't know from the written order. But if you look at the minute order, which is in the respondent's appendix on the in limine hearing, it does say, hey, he's not qualified. But what he would need to do to be qualified is uncertain, Your Honor. And the sense that I got was really that he needed to be licensed, but he couldn't say by what organization or how the lack of licensure, honestly, took away from his 27 years of law enforcement experience. And he had a unique ability because of his 27 years with Metro and Henderson Police Department to go through the approximately 26,000 calls for service near that location, the ATM. So our position, and I just want to focus on one additional thing in Hallmark before I move on to the next issue. But in Hallmark, where the court expands, this is on page 499 of the opinion, that's the pinpoint site, or 650 to 651 in the Pacific site. It says, in determining whether a person is properly qualified, a district court should consider formal schooling and academic degrees, licensure, and then also employment experience, practical experience, and specialized training. We know that Mr. Simon had experience, employment experience, practical experience, and specialized training. So on the second issue, this was our attempt to call Elizabeth Dunbaugh, who is the defense security expert within our case in chief. And the statute that this argument is based upon is NRS 50.15115 and then sub 4 A and B. And really the plain language of this statute says that we can call an adverse party, so we could have called the defendant, corporate representative, or a witness identified with an adverse party. Obviously, Ms. Dumbaugh was identified with the adverse party. She was their expert, security expert. Now, the defense says, hey, well, this was just a discretionary decision, but that's not accurate. That would make sub A of the statute swallow sub 4. And so one of the cases we relied upon to illustrate this statute is the Bhatia versus District Court case, which it says courts have repeatedly observed that once a party is given testimony through deposition or expert reports, those opinions do not belong to one party or another, but rather are available for all parties to use at trial. And if you look at Ms. Dumbaugh's expert report, which is in the record at Trial Exhibit 14, it's in our appendix, the appellant's appendix at Volume 4, 576 to 599. If you look at her expert report, it really looks in a lot of ways like Mr. Sutton's expert report, because she goes through and she talks about lighting and she talks about placement of the ATM. Now, and Judge Bullitt, to follow up on your earlier question about another ground that Judge, I'm remembering Judge Crockett, he says, well, Mr. Simon didn't talk about NRS 660. Well, if you look at Ms. Dumbaugh's expert report, she mentions NRS 660. She doesn't go through all the elements of the statute that we're talking about. And so really, this should have been a battle of the experts, factual issues to be determined by the jury. And one thing that kind of blindsided us, and we pointed this out in our briefs a little bit, but the representation was made, hey, plaintiff, you don't need to call Ms. Dumbaugh in your case in chief. You'll have the opportunity to cross-examine her in the defense case in chief. And that discussion was in volume 4 of the appellant's appendix, around 699 to 700. And that's where both the judge and defense counsel says, limit this to cross-examination. Well, of course, we never got to cross-examination. And so that's how we were unfairly prejudiced. What we would have drawn out of Ms. Dumbaugh was the fact that despite her expert report, we would have drawn from her admissions based upon her expert report that Bank of America didn't comply with any of the provisions in NRS 660, which also goes towards we have a single common law claim for negligence. The statutes really just illustrate our negligence claim. And so let me briefly go through our last issue here, whether there was sufficient evidence for the jury. Obviously, if the court agrees with us on the first or the second issue, there would be grounds for a new trial. But even if the court disagrees with us on issues 1 and 2, this third issue really also provides an independent basis for the court to grant a new trial. NRS 660.195 and 660.215 absolutely create a duty from Bank of America running to plaintiff. And to the extent that any of the plain language of the statute is ambiguous, we attach the legislative history of these statutes. And one of the things that Bank of America just doesn't touch is the crime statistics off the property. And really, that's where our expert comes into play. But there was some great testimony that we got out of David Robinson, who was Bank of America's witness. I realized we represented him as a 36 witness. That's what we had always thought of him as. Bank of America filed a supplemental brief, a surreply, and said, no, he wasn't a 30B6 witness. Our position on that is it doesn't really matter, because this is Bank of America's duty under the under NRS Chapter 660 to satisfy all those factors. And so in order to look at foreseeability, we went back 5 years with our expert, and then we said, hey, you know, our expert said, there's enough here to show foreseeability. Bank of America should have known about this. But what David Robinson says is, I would need multiple crimes happening on that property over the course of a week, and then, you know, within a week, then multiple times in a month. And so that's just not a standard that comports with any law. Your Honor, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Eccles. Mr. Dorme.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Dorme on behalf of Bank of America. I guess I'll follow the order that counsel has used in this, and I'll talk about Mr. Simon first. To answer Justice Bulla's question, the court absolutely considered many factors outside of Mr. Simon's certification. That was but one thing that the court noted he lacked. The court struck him on the grounds that he had never testified in a deposition or court regarding forensic security consulting. He had never authored an expert report in this area. He had no relevant licensure or certification. He had never been hired by a bank to perform security analysis or any other issues such as ATM placement, architecture of buildings, landscaping, lighting, these types of things. The court also noted that he did not belong to any organizations that these type of experts belong to, and had authored no papers in this area. The court further noted that he had no knowledge of relevant federal banking statutes or national standards. Most significantly, he failed to rely on recognized source materials for his opinion. And counsel pointed out that he was going to testify about NRS 66195. The court was clear in pointing out that Mr. Simon didn't even cite to that statute in his expert report, which the court noted at a minimum he would have expected. Despite these lack of qualifications, Gautam asserted that Mr. Simon should be permitted to testify regarding roving security patrols, their effectiveness, and whether they could prevent this incident or future crimes. However, during the offer of proof, which, by the way, was the second bite of the apple that got to qualify Mr. Simon, Judge Crockett specifically questioned him on this precise issue, and Mr. Simon acknowledged his opinions in that regard were not based on any source materials whatsoever. So the court, as a referee of evidence, has a duty to ensure that only qualified witnesses testify as experts. The court methodically went through the lack of Mr. Simon's qualifications and recognized that his testimony was not reliable and would not assist the jury. He properly struck Mr. Simon and precluded him from testifying as an expert in this case, as he simply did not meet the minimum threshold requirements required by NRS 5275 or Hallmark. With respect to Ms. Dumbaugh, the point that I would make on that issue is that, actually, if I can go back to Mr. Simon for one last thing, I wanted to also add that counsel mentioned that Mr. Simon was going to testify regarding these 26,000 calls for service that were made in the relevant time period. However, the district court didn't allow that document in as evidence because it was not produced during discovery. So his testimony would have had no foundation in that regard anyhow. Back to Ms. Dumbaugh. NRS 50.115 makes it clear that the court is to exercise reasonable control over the order and mode of interrogation of witnesses and presentation of evidence. Counsel's asserts that subsection 4 would be swallowed by section A if that Subsection A was controlling. However, that is not the case. Subsection 4, that right still exists. It's just subject to the discretion of the court. The Nevada Supreme Court has said the court has a duty and an obligation to control the proceedings before it. That's the Casey case that we cited. That duty is, in this regard, the court is granted considerable discretion. That's the Screen versus Screen case. So in this instance, Gotham's construction of this statute would render it conflicts with the lead-in to NRS 5115. It usurps the court's inherent authority, and it would render that lead-in meaningless. The Nevada Supreme Court has stated time and again that no portion of a statute is to be rendered meaningless. With respect to prejudice to Mr. Gotham, the court, not defense counsel, noted that he would not be prejudiced as he would have had a fair and full opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Dumbaugh on whatever issue she testified about if she had been called in the defense case in chief. But we never got to that point because Mr. Gotham did not put on sufficient evidence to establish a prima facie case of breach. And that leads me to the final point, which
so
is the
Mr.
NRC.
Dorme?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So the court exercised its discretion and said this witness should not be called by the plaintiff, wait for cross-examination. But once it became apparent that there wasn't going to be any cross-examination, does that change the way that you look at it? Because the prejudice becomes obvious at that point?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because that decision was made after the plaintiff's case in chief. The decision to preclude Ms. Dumbaugh was made prior to that. So the court had no idea there was not going to be a defense case. It was only after the presentation of evidence, which lacked sufficient evidence, that the case was dismissed. So I don't think it changes the analysis.
Okay,
that was just but one factor anyways. The court, as I noted, has considerable discretion to control these things. And the court believed it was prejudicial to Bank of America to allow Gotham to have the first crack at Ms. Dumbaugh's testimony.
Mr. Dorme, was your expert in the courtroom listening to the appellant's case in chief?
She was present for part of the trial, yes.
And I believe, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I believe that the appellant's counsel had actually subpoenaed her as well for trial.
That is correct. It was, the judge saw that as a tactic to sort of undo what had been previously not done by the plaintiff. Counsel showed up with a check during trial and was trying to, you know, make payment to Ms. Dumbaugh. The subpoena was issued. I'm not sure exactly the date of the subpoena was issued. I suspect it was issued pre-trial, but it was kind of a half-baked attempt. And the court saw through that and believed it was prejudicial to Bank of America.
The federal rules do not suggest that experts are aligned with the party. Is there a reason that we should follow the federal rule in this case?
No, I don't believe so. I think NRS 5115 is clear. We don't need to resort to the federal rules. There is some federal authority out there that takes a contrary position to those cited by the plaintiff. I think it's Federal Rule 611 discusses this, and it's equivalent to NRS 50-115, and it doesn't even contain language such as the use of the word shall with regard to the court's control over the proceedings. It says that the court should exercise reasonable control. I think the Nevada statute is clear and unambiguous and imposes a duty on the court to control the trial, including expert witnesses, which is what the judge believed the statute also applied to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Moving on to the final issue, the NRCP 50 motion. Justices, this case boils down to a lack of evidence. The district court properly concluded after plaintiff's case in chief that he simply had not put up put forth sufficient evidence to establish a breach on the part of Bank of America of any duty that it may have owed to Mr. Gautam. As we pointed out in our papers, which the court agreed with, that these statutes, NRS 6C-195 and the other statutes contained in that section, are defensive in nature and exist to insulate a bank from liability. The court correctly noted that if a bank intends to rely on those statutes as a defense, then that is when the burden would shift to the bank to establish substantial compliance with those statutes. Plaintiff has relied heavily on Mr. Robinson's testimony, but if you look at the cited testimony, excuse me, in the papers, it does not support a finding of noncompliance. Mr. Robinson was testifying of his own personal knowledge, and not as a 30B6 witness. So with respect to the lighting issue, for example, he agreed with what the statute language says, but he also testified he did not know how measurements were taken, did not know what type of testing is to be done or what type of equipment is used in that regard. With respect to the crime statistics, he again stated that he doesn't consider crime off the property when an ATM machine has already been installed. This machine was installed in 1992. He testified that the location team is responsible for complying with NRS 6C-195, and that is done at the time the machine's installed, which is what the statute states. The court recognized this and surmised as to why there had not been any evidence or testimony from anyone establishing that the location team did not perform these tasks as outlined in the statute.
But Mr. Dormey, don't conditions change over time? Don't situations change over time? So even though the ATM was installed in 1992, there could be a change in crime statistics or a change in conditions that might require the bank to relook at its safety precautions in the area. Would that not be correct?
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor, but the statute NRS 6C-195, which is what plaintiff relied on as to support his theory of breach, states this must be done at the time the ATM is installed. Now, if we're talking about an ordinary negligence claim, I would agree. Things change over time. But in this particular case, as the court noted, there was never any testimony put forth that the lighting on this property was inadequate. There was never any testimony that the landscaping was obstructive. There's never any testimony that there weren't adequate safety warnings on the property. There was never any testimony that Bank of America did not inspect the property or consider crime. Mr. Robinson's testimony doesn't establish that Bank of America didn't consider these things. He was speaking from himself, for himself and his department. Plaintiff could have called the proper NRCP 30B6 witness to address these issues, and they simply did not. Plaintiff called witnesses that had no personal knowledge and lacked foundation of the relevant topics and lacked foundation to establish a breach on the part of Bank of America. Finally, plaintiff relied on the testimony of the 30B6 witness from Metro. However, Ms. Davis's testimony merely establishes that in her 23 years in that position, she had never seen a request from Bank of America for crime data in the area where this ATM was located. But again, this machine was installed prior to her commencing her employment with Metro, so she lacked foundation to make that assertion. Moreover, she conceded on cross-examination that she had no personal knowledge of whether Bank of America had requested this information or considered it. She testified that Metro receives thousands of these things a year, requests per year, as many as 300 per week, and that she sees maybe 5 per week. So her testimony does not establish noncompliance. And lastly, NRCP 50 requires that a party put forth sufficient evidence such that a reasonable jury could find in its favor. Bank of America was not required to establish compliance with these statutes in plaintiff's case in chief. This was going to be done in the defense case by the defense expert, but we never got to that point because plaintiff didn't meet his burden of putting forth a prima facie case of breach. And the court properly noted that based on the lack of evidence, that Bank of America's NRCP 50 motion had to be granted, and we agree with that. And unless the court has any other questions for me, I will just wrap up by saying that Bank of America respectfully requests that this court affirm the lower court's decision granting the NRCP 50 motion.
So, Mr. Dorme, one question. Let's assume for a moment the court agrees with the appellant on one or more of the arguments. In this case, is sent back for a new trial. What would happen then on this expert witness situation? Judge Crockett retired, so he wouldn't be hearing the case, but he did make comments during that hearing at the beginning of the trial that, Mr. Simon, you have good, he didn't say good qualifications, you have experience, but you're not quite there yet to qualify as an expert. Someday you may be there. You know, he said something to that effect. So let's say this case goes to trial in 2022. You know, with the backlog in the court system, it probably wouldn't be any earlier than that. Would the plaintiff be able to call Mr. Simon again, or substitute some other expert, or substitute some other person most knowledgeable? Or, you know, how do you see this unfolding if there was a remand?
Well, Your Honor, discovery is closed. I suppose if this court finds that Mr. Simon should have been able to testify, I would suspect that plaintiff would be able to put him on at any retrial. However, the evidence, being that discovery is closed, is still the same. Mr. Simon's opinions were based in large part on this 600-page document with all of these calls that was never produced and will not come into evidence, even at a retrial. So I don't think the evidence doesn't change. It's still going to be the same even in a retrial. And Mr. Simon's testimony will still lack foundation and not be based on evidence in the record.
Okay, thank you very much. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Eccles, then you have a brief time for rebuttal, or 3.5 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. So on this issue about the 26,000 calls for service, those calls were delineated in Mr. Simon's expert report, which is included in the respondent's appendix. And the notion that he could not rely upon those because they weren't admissible in evidence or disclosed or whatever the argument was. Well, we have NRS 50.275 that allows experts to rely upon summaries, for example, inadmissible evidence. And so I don't see that as being a barrier to Mr. Simon's testimony. On the Elizabeth Dunbaugh issue about the subpoena, we subpoenaed her. There was never any, you know, nobody challenged that subpoena on appeal, and nobody challenged it below. And so the subpoenaing of her during trial was not an issue. And Judge Bullis, she was there observing. Now, to me, it, you know, for the bank to say that it was prejudicial to them to have us take the first crack at Ms. Dunbaugh, I could see that as a discretionary decision, but only if we were actually given the chance to cross-examine her. The fact that we were not given the chance to cross-examine her, we were prejudiced. And if you look at, we cited the language when Mr. Cloward, who was the trial counsel, when he rested for the plaintiffs, he says, the plaintiffs will rest, but we want to bring up the Ms. Dunbaugh issue because we wanted to call her in our case in chief. And Judge, you did not allow us to. And so he, not only was there a preservation of that at the time, but he specifically made that, he carved out that issue in his closing when the plaintiffs rested. Now on the statutes, NRS 660, The legislative history pointed out in our reply brief, I just want to mention some of that. This is in our appellant's reply appendix. There's only one volume at pages 7 through 8, and then also pages 11 through 13. But the purpose of these statutes was standards for safety of customers using automated teller machines, and then also well accepted among the bank security industry. So that's really the purpose of these statutes. If you look at these statutes in a negligence per se light, we have duty and breach once we've established the violation of these statutes. These statutes are not defensive statutes. It's not our requirement as a plaintiff to show that the bank violated these statutes. It's their duty to show that they took all the precautions so that there wouldn't be a factual question for the jury and potential liability here. It's kind of like if you take the banana peel cases, Your Honor, and say, I don't have to prove that they didn't do the sweep logs. They have to say, hey, I did the sweep logs, therefore I didn't have notice. It's their burden to satisfy these things. And I just want to mention one additional provision in the statute. In NRS 660.195, counsel represented that the procedure that needs to be adopted is only for the time when the ATM is installed. But there's no end date in the statute. If we were to read, hey, and it's limited to the time when the ATM is installed, that would be reading language into the statute that is just not there. And I'll also point out, and this is my last point, in subsection 2 of that same statute, it provides a grandfather provision, which does not apply in this case because, as the court already recognized, this ATM was installed in 1992, not before October 1, 1991. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Eccles, I want to ask you the same thing I asked Mr. Dornemy, but just to shorten it, do you agree with his characterization of what would happen if there was a remand? It's essentially going to be a repeat of where we are from the trial in 2019.
Yes, Your Honor. So if there is a remand and a new trial and Mr. Simon is allowed to testify, I think that would have to be under the discretion of the new judge about the parameters that Mr. Simon could testify to. But, if there's any information that he wanted to rely upon, he should be able to.
Okay. But
any new information.
Mr. Dormey also indicated that none of this other evidence would come in, that you already addressed the hearsay and the documents, whether they were disclosed. But he said discovery is closed, so the case is set in stone as to what there is.
And, Your Honor, that would depend on whether the judge reopened discovery or not, which we might want to do if there is a remand.
All right. I mean, these are hypothetical. I'm not saying, and don't take from this, that the court is going to remand the case. I'm trying to just look at all the possibilities.
Definitely, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Judge Tower, Judge Bullitt, do you have anything further?
Thank you all very much.
Yes, thank you, guys. This is an interesting case, and thank you for the good argument.
Thank
all
you,
right.
Your Honor.
Thank you, yes. Your Honors.
Yes, both counsel did an excellent job. It's very helpful. And we hope to see you in person again the next time. All right, we'll take this case under submission, and we'll be in recess.